Thanks for dialing in. This is John Williams. Tom Gimbel's the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Welcome back, Tom. How are you today?
I'm great, John. Good to be with you. How are you?
Pretty good. I know you've been still thinking and writing about the Friday, August jobs report. Where's your head on those numbers today?
I think that if you add almost 250,000 jobs, that's good. My guess is when we do the September report that these will get updated a little bit and be better than what we thought. And it shows that economists are basing things off of past information and data points that aren't always right. And a growing economy is a growing economy.
The Delta variant is scaring off customers. I saw a report on Yahoo about that. What does that mean, and what do you think of that?
Well, what you have is that whether it's travel and leisure or hospitality, is that Delta is scaring people off. You have businesses that are hiring people, and they're growing fast, but there are certain sectors that I just mentioned that aren't. And so you have Delta that's similar to the school system. People are wondering if Governor Pritzker is going to shut down the school system in September or October. And if that happens, now you have daycare issues again, and what will happen to those employees that are going back to work. So there is that aspect. Now, personally, I talk to CEOs and heads of HR every single day, and I don't think that companies are going to slow down with the Delta variant. And I think people are a little bit fed up of being told to be in a holding pattern. So while it's a scary thing, I'm not denying that, I don't think people are ready to slow down their lifestyles again.
I'm sorry, but I mean, are you saying that the businesses are going to go full speed ahead? But it seems to me like you've got two problems there. One is employees, and the other one is people's willingness to spend money on whatever the goods or services they're offering, right?
Well, the employees are a real issue, but I think we're still feeling that a little bit more in the hospitality, blue-collar, and service sectors than we are in white-collar positions. It's coming, and it's there, but just not as much of pain as there is in those other areas, though I've never seen a demand for labor quite like what I've seen. What you're going to see is people that are going to get paid more to do jobs, which is a good thing for people who are working. While they might not always want to work more, they're going to be working more and making more money, and that's a positive. And I think that with the Delta variant, it seems like if you're reading a lot, which I tend to do, and of reputable folks, that while it is worse, that as long as the vaccine rates stay high, that it's not as bad for people who've been vaccinated. And that's a heck of a lot better situation than we were a year ago at this time.
We have so many anecdotal text messages, email, phone calls from listeners in the last couple of weeks. For instance, today, somebody said they couldn't get ice at the grocery store because the company that makes the ice couldn't find anybody to deliver it. The baristas aren't at the Starbucks still, so they're still not having in-store services at some stores. And the list just goes on and on of people who say, I couldn't get this or do that because there's no employees to do that work. We've been saying for months that they're going to come back. They're going to come back. But how quickly are they going to come back?
Well, we're going to see it now, and we're going to see how much there is truth about the federal unemployment of how that number will affect it. So I think we probably got to give it 2 months, September and October, to see how that affects it. I was just talking to a gentleman who owns several restaurants in Chicago, and he ran into one of his former executive chefs who was probably making $80,000 or $90,000 a year. It wasn't a hugely upscale restaurant. And he had only worked there for about 5 months, and he quit during COVID. And he said, what are you up to these days? And he said, I just got tired of the grind, so now I'm driving an Uber and I'm making my own pickles, right? now, how long that lasts without federal money coming in? And so you got people that were 1099 contractors, like driving an Uber or making your own pickles, and I get it, those are extremes, but that are still getting money off of federal unemployment. When that stops, people are going to need to come and get jobs again. And so I do think it may not be 100% what we need, but I do think it's going to curve it up 20 to 30%, and that'll be a big relief for a lot of folks.
And you think that's the big one? That's the big last domino that needs to drop?
I've been looking for dominoes, John, and if that's not it, I don't know where the other ones are. So we've got a situation that people are either living together at 5 or 10, 15 people in one house that we're not seeing like it's 1935, or we've got a situation where the government's been putting people on the dole, and hopefully that'll unwind. But I think it's going to be a little bit different than a quick fix in September. Like I said, I think it'll take until October, November for that to bed out.
We'll keep talking through then and the rest of the year. Thank you, Tom.
You got it, John. Stay healthy.
Tom Gimbel, founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. His website is thelasallenetwork.com. Philip Weiss joins us again on the Wintrust Business Lunch, president at Seyfarth at Work. I'll give you the website in just a second. Philip, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
You are talking about the trend, people may be working at home, and the job creeps past 5 o'clock into the rest of their life day. What's the new trend about this?
Yeah, it's really, as you're stating, a byproduct of all this at-home work, but it started before the pandemic as a movement. It's really what's called the right to disconnect. And really, it's a reaction to the fact that employees are not able to put up their own barriers between work and non-work time. And so the companies have realized from a mental health standpoint, from a physical health standpoint, they may need to be the ones doing it. And an interesting trend, John, it started in Europe with 4 countries actually making it the law of the land that employees need to be disconnected in some way, not required to answer emails, for example. And now, in 2021, U.S. executives are looking at what's happening in Europe and saying, we might need policies like those laws to give our employees an enforced break.
So how do you structure that? I mean, does it end at 5? Is there a little fudge time there?
Yeah, I mean, that is exactly the question that these CEOs are asking us and themselves. Because if you put a blockade at exactly 5 p.m., we know there's a little bit of trickle work that's going to happen afterwards.
Yeah.
We know that if you turn off the email, which some companies have actually done, they've affirmatively shut off the system, right at the stroke of 5, you're going to lose business and you're going to have issues with employee morale in the other direction. So they're trying different approaches. In some cases, they may have an email block at 10 p.m., and then the email comes back on at 6 or 7 a.m., so everything comes over the next morning with an additional policy or encouraging messages to keep the emails to a minimum until that late-night deadline. In other cases, it's simply a company rule, which, of course, they may or may not be able to enforce. So they're experimenting with using the technology and using policies as well.
I think you're describing it, though, as kind of a top-down thing. Some of that's horizontal. It's peer-to-peer, and some of us appreciate the opportunity to reach out to a colleague during off hours.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And the companies that have been doing this successfully, they're telling their employees, this is not a communication ban in all cases. It's also not a work ban. I mean, you can't tell an employee you can't work in the evening because there's no way to enforce that, nor would you. But the reality is, if it's a work matter, companies want to be able to give employees a break. And they're telling their staff, if it's urgent, use a text, use the phone call. We're not saying don't ever work. We're not saying don't have a collegial connection with your coworkers. We're saying if it's a work communication and it can wait, it should wait.
I'm just relating to this personally, Philip, because in my business, it's a 24/7 operation, and my producer will get messages from me in the evening and on weekends. And a lot of times I'll say up front, hey, sorry to bother you at this hour. In fact, Elif reached out to me over the weekend and started her message to me that way. Sorry to bother you on a holiday. And it wasn't even a work-related thing, but she just didn't want to occupy my space, which I respect. But I wonder what you make of that, at least if you put that caveat up front. I know I'm in your space. I presume that's a good way to start that message.
It is. And, you know, you're right. As a starting point, John, there are some of what we might call no-go industries, places where this is just not going to work for all kinds of reasons. They're maybe on urgent deadlines all the time, and it might be a news-breaking situation. You may have global clients that, frankly, are online when you're not, and they may need an answer. So you're absolutely right. There's got to be some reasonable limits. And showing respect and showing recognition of people's private time is a key piece. Having said that, John, we've had situations where managers would send a question to their employees on a Saturday and say, do not answer it till Monday. And the employee said, answer the email, and were asked, why would you do that? Why would you interrupt your weekend? And the employee said, because you emailed me on a Saturday. You got me thinking about it. Of course I'm going to respond.
Yeah.
So there's that piece as well. But you're right. Respect is part of the process.
Maybe if managers treated it the way attorneys do, and every time you turn on the clock, it's a billable quarter hour, they'd be less likely to send out off-hour inquiries, you know?
Yeah, well, that is actually kind of a telling insight, because a lot of executives are saying, we got to give people a sense that there's a real value to every minute of somebody's time. So while you're talking about actually billing, it's that philosophy they're trying to really imprint on people before they interrupt each other's weekend or late evening.
Only related to that this way, Philip, this isn't what we're talking about, but I recently had an attorney doing some work for me, and there were times where I was hesitant to pick up the phone and call him or even respond to a message from him, because I thought, as soon as I do, that's going to cost me $65. And maybe this could wait, or it could be combined with other matters later on. So I was almost hesitant to reach out to him because I knew it was going to cost me. Perhaps the segue is, if managers thought that way, they'd be less likely to send out missives at off hours, right?
Oh, absolutely. And maybe the cost for most industries is not financial in the moment, but it's going to be burnout over the course of a year. People will get much less creative after 50 hours of work per week. And there was a really interesting study in Science, published in Science Daily magazine, that was entitled Killing Me Softly. And it talked about how each minute or half hour of off-the-clock work really had deleterious health effects on employees. So there is a cost. It might be something that a lawyer can't bill for, but we all might pay the price over time.
Yeah, maybe you saw there was a story over the, I guess it was last week, about the amount of extra work people are doing in that very thing. I don't know, is that new with the pandemic, or is that maybe just exacerbated by the pandemic?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. The electronic world we live in, the virtual communication world, the fact that people have been relying on email for years now and get instant responses, that's produced this ever-increasing amount of after-hours engagement and work. The pandemic then accelerated it. There's actually a hashtag, which you may have seen, John, called the Sunday Scaries, hashtag Sunday Scaries, which is this phenomenon related to what you're talking about, that people get increasingly nervous on Sunday about the upcoming week because they never really unplugged, and yet they haven't done all the work they were supposed to do the week before. By being focused on work on Saturday and Sunday, they have tremendous angst as they hit Sunday night. So there's a lot here, to your point, that we want to be thinking about.
It's a whole new kind of FOMO, isn't it? Like, I'm afraid I'm missing out on the work I should be doing over the weekend, and then you can't enjoy Saturday and Sunday. That's Philip Weiss. He's the president at Seyfarth at Work. Seyfarthatwork.com is the website. Spell it Seyfarth. Thanks, Philip. We'll visit again.
Thanks for having me, John.
Jim Dahlke is a regular guest, the senior editor at Chicago Inno. Welcome back, Jim.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Kind of intrigued by this story you wrote, NFTs in Chicago. As much as we've talked and laughed and tried to figure these things out, I never thought about a Chicago connection per se. What are you writing about?
Yeah, that's right. So NFTs, or otherwise known as non-fungible tokens, have really taken off, you know, across the country and across the world. And locally, you know, a community of artists and collectors and investors is really starting to take shape here in the city. There's a couple of different initiatives we highlighted in that piece, but, you know, kind of a central point of this community is actually at a physical art gallery called I'm Not Art. They launched earlier this year, and we're the first physical art gallery in Chicago dedicated to NFTs. So they have the big screens where they can kind of showcase some of these digital works in the physical world. And just the other weekend, they held their very first in-person auction and had 11 pieces from 7 different artists on display. And all told, they had a combined sale of over $140,000 worth of those pieces, the most expensive piece going for about $22,000. So a really, you know, kind of smashing start for these guys who are really among the beginning folks in the NFT community in Chicago.
Okay, here's the challenge for you, Jim. In 20 seconds or less, explain NFTs. Go.
So NFTs is essentially a technology that's built on the blockchain that certifies a digital asset. So what it kind of does for the art world is you create a digital artwork and you mint it by putting it on the blockchain. It basically creates a digital identity for your artwork. Essentially, the blockchain will tell you who created that artwork, how many of them there are, how rare it is. And basically, it assigns a tag to it that makes tracing it essentially 100%. A really, really interesting thing that this means for the art community is that somebody who creates an NFT and it is sold and then it sells again and again and again, that original artist can earn money every time that piece is sold. So unlike the traditional art world where when you sell it, you've sold it and it's gone, an NFT can basically give you royalties, you know, in perpetuity every time you sell a piece.
That's more than 20 seconds, Jim.
Fair. It's difficult. I mean, I know there's a lot to learn about all this stuff, and it is a little bit confusing, but there's quite a bit of money to be made in these early days, and the art community is really rallying around it.
You said unlike traditional artwork, though, but is this not also true that if I do own the NFT of a piece of art, I neither claim physical possession of the artwork, but I don't have the rights to it, so other people can use it? I really don't have anything but that digital certificate, right?
That's right. Digital certificate is sort of the perfect way to put it. But, you know, the way that people are sort of using NFTs is really interesting in how they sort of display their digital identity. So on Twitter, you'll see a lot of people put, NFTs that they've purchased as their avatar. In different kind of online communities, people are sort of using this as a profile picture. So that's kind of the early use case here. But, you know, as our lives become more and more digital and we have more of our life on the internet, folks are going to use, you know, these pieces of artwork to sort of express their digital identity the way that, you know, we use clothes to express our physical identity in the real world.
One Chicago artist among those exhibiting their work at auction sold a piece called Until We Meet Again for more than $9,000. Presumably the person that bought the NFT for that knows the artist or the work. And again, they don't gain possession of it, but they now have the digital stamp for that thing for $9,000. And the list goes on. The names of these companies, again, are what again in Chicago?
So I'm Not Art is the group that does the physical art gallery in Chicago.
Talk to me about this University of Illinois-based startup building bionic hands.
Yeah, so a really interesting startup down at U of I called Psionic. They've created a really high-tech prosthesis that has a sensory feedback to its users. So the device uses sensors that are embedded in the fingertips of the hand. So when a user touches an object, the skin is actually stimulated electronically, giving off the tingling or a vibration sensation. It's a product that was developed back in 2015, and they've been slowly building away at it, and it hit the market officially last week. So, you know, really interesting device in a lot of ways. It's kind of, you know, among the moonshot projects, right, that we've kind of identified in Chicago as, you know, a startup taking a really, really ambitious approach at a really big problem. So it was, you know, the founder, you know, sort of came to this idea from his native town in Pakistan, where he met a 7-year-old without an arm and really kind of wanted to create a more affordable prosthetic for folks. So really kind of their selling point here is that this device is affordable, and they're able to use some, you know, affordable products within the build to get the price down.
So that I use the muscles in my forearm to sort of pull the levers, if you will, to make it work electronically?
That's exactly right. So, yeah, so you're basically able to kind of like use those muscles that are higher up in the body to kind of control the hand itself. So, you know, really, really innovative product here. There are some other, similar-ish products out on the market, but, you know, what they really say is they're able to kind of get the price down based on the materials that they use. And it's covered by most insurance, they say.
Wow. So are these in the market? Are people actually using them? Have they been attached?
That's right. So, yes, these are in the market. They've got some pretty great videos online of people doing push-ups with these hands and using different tools. So they're very durable as well.
What's the Melinda Gates story you wrote?
Yeah, Melinda Gates-backed group is launching in Chicago. The group is called All Raise, and their whole initiative is to back women in tech. So Melinda Gates' fund, Pivotal Ventures, is an investor in All Raise. And All Raise is launching a Chicago chapter. So this is another example of a Silicon Valley group really kind of wanting to plant their flag in the city. And they've tapped several well-known Chicago founders and tech folks in the city to kind of continue to grow this thing here locally. And really the goal is to provide mentoring and events and resources to really close that funding gap. Most of the funding venture capital-wise goes to male founders, not just in Chicago, but all over the place. And what All Raise is looking to do is really change that and actually get more women in the venture capital industry as well on the investor side. So pretty cool group backed by Melinda Gates that's really trying to put the pedal to the metal here in Chicago.
Amen to that. Always fascinating stuff. Jim Dahlke, senior editor at Chicago Inno. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, John.
12:44 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The Duchossois family-operated Duchossois Group has agreed to sell its Chamberlain Group unit to private equity firm Blackstone. The transaction is valued at $5 billion, according to Cranes. Chamberlain makes garage door openers and security products and is the main industrial holding for Duchossois. Other terms have not been disclosed, but the report says the family will retain some control over Chamberlain, including two seats on the company's board. Duchossois's portfolio of investments includes rail car leasing, energy, and other interests, including Churchill Downs, which acquired a controlling stake in Arlington International Racecourse in 2000. The National Science Foundation has granted $25 million to the University of Chicago for research into how quantum physics could be used for advances in biology. Quantum research involves using subatomic particles to transmit data, and that could make computers and other devices more powerful. It's largely unproven, but researchers in government, academia, and the private sector are spending billions on what could be the next major leap in technology. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of food, here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, I like it, John, when I can incorporate one of my favorite TV shows into the business of food.
Okay.
So let's begin in the locker room. It's before the big game. Coach Eric Taylor of the Dillon Panthers has a few words.
Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose.
Friday Night Lights is back in full swing across the Midwest, and along with full hearts, there are full bellies thanks to what has become a symbol of Illinois high school football games, the pork chop sandwich. So, the Illinois High School Association is teaming up with the Illinois pork producers to crown the best high school concession stand pork chop sandwich in Illinois. Entries are flooding in, including from Barrington High School.
I'm Heath McFall. I'm an associate principal here at Barrington High School.
And tell us about Barrington's pork chop sandwich.
It's really an entire eating experience, right? The pork chop is grilled to perfection. It's highlighted by that perfect sauce. I can't spill the recipe on that one. Of course, it soaks into the bun a little bit. Don't wear a white T-shirt, though. You're not going to want to have any sauce on you.
Okay, good and messy.
It's a messy experience, but if you haven't had a Barrington pork chop sandwich, you haven't had a pork chop sandwich yet.
I bet I can find somebody who disagrees.
My name is Ryan O'Connor.
Ryan and his wife Tanya have been running the concession stand at Bishop McNamara in Kankakee for 14 years, and their pork chop sandwich?
I believe it is the best in state.
Just like Barrington High School, Bishop McNamara uses pork chops cut fresh the day of the game. And you think you have a secret weapon, Ryan?
They are seasoned with a dry rub. The gentleman that cuts the meat for us has come up with this rub, and we cook them on a custom-built open-flame grill. We want them fresh off the grill, piping hot, and in the customer's hand as quickly as possible.
Dozens of entries have come in. I also spoke with Rob Kaninishu, the president of the Batavia High School Booster Club, who says fresh-cut pork chops from Reams and Elburn and a potato roll are what make their sandwich delish. And how about a shout-out to all of the hardworking booster clubs who do such great things, raising money for high schools? You know, John, I was wondering who's going to judge this contest. It seems like a perfect job for a major market midday radio host, doesn't it? Today's Farm to Your Belly feature, it's National Beer Lovers Day, and to go along with that, it's National Salami Day.
I don't want to interrupt you, but earlier this morning when you were talking about this pork chop contest, I believe you threw the judging props to the morning show host, Bob Surratt.
He rejected it.
So fair enough. I'd be happy to be second to Bob Surratt, but I can be the judge if...
Second only because his show's on before yours. So.
Fair enough.
But that's the business of food and football on 720 WGN.
Maureen Martino joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Let's talk about the Lakeview East Chamber of Commerce Festival of Arts. Hi, Maureen. You're on WGN.
Hi. How is everybody doing today?
We're doing good, and you're just up the road a little bit from where I'm standing right now. Tell us about your event.
Well, it's our annual event. This is our 16th year. We lost last year due to COVID, but we're bringing in 100 artists, and we also have two music stages. Everything that is in this event is really kind of hyper-local. Dry Hop Brewery is our brewery in our neighborhood in Lakeview here, and they're going to be serving up the beer. We've got local food vendors that are only from our neighborhood, whether it be Brazilian food, Latin food, sweets. Even we even have waffles with hot dogs. Of course, the main event is the artists, and we are just so excited to bring them all back and be able to, you know, share their talent that they have been put aside for a while due to COVID.
This is the Lakeview Festival of Arts. It takes place on Halsted, right? From like Belmont. What are the boundaries of this?
It's on Broadway, and it's from Belmont to Hawthorne. So it's a couple blocks, and we also do, we create a garden in the middle of the street, which has always been a surprise to the people that come. They all know what the theme is, and they'll be able to see it this weekend. That's by Patch Landscaping, puts this beautiful garden in the street as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I've been to this thing the last 2 years that you did have it. Sure. And you're walking along, and it's a nice neighborhood festival, and the art really is nice. This is I don't know if some are better than others. This one's very good. But as you're coming along, you depending on which direction you access it from, there's this landscaping in the middle of the street that is enormous and impressive. For that alone, I think you guys stand out.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what makes us a little special, too, is that we don't hire a producer. It's put on really by the Arts Committee from the Chamber and also 100 volunteers. So we're able to be flexible and change things and make it work for our community. So we're really, really proud of it.
So we're doing it September 11th and 12th, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. Is it just those 2 days, or are you doing it Friday as well?
We're not doing Friday. Traditionally, we have, but I thought we would leave the streets open this year for the businesses that lost so much. So we're going to be closing the streets down early on Saturday, and so it'll be 11 to 7 both days. And on Saturday, we're having some after bands that play till 10 o'clock.
That's the delicate dance you do, right? You attract a lot of people there, but then if it's hard to access the businesses, then the businesses suffer, and yet you're bringing a lot of people into the neighborhood. So maybe 2 days is a good compromise, huh?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we made a little bit, we've been talking to business affairs and trying to kind of incorporate what we did on Broadway south of Belmont, where we had the dine-outs and the restaurants were in the streets, to try to permit some of the restaurants to be able to put their tables and chairs and not have to go through the expense of having a food vendor and getting, you know, everybody know restaurant workers are hard to find now and restaurants are being closed more days than they hope for. So we're trying to work and offering a little bit different of a permitting process too this year. So we're excited to have that as part of a partnership with the City of Chicago.
That sounds like a good idea. Can you describe any of the art? Give us one of the local artists.
Oh, my gosh. We have a lot. I mean, the poster image this year is from is Kelsey Merkel from New York. And the image you'll see on all our promotions is Hydrangeans, and she's this beautiful piece of work. She does mixed media, primarily paint and acrylics. We have everything from some ceramics to painting on oil and wood. There's something for everyone, and I think there's price points for everyone, too, so that if you're looking for something, it's moving season. We know everybody's been moving around. I see the moving trucks in the neighborhood all the time, so this is a great opportunity to be able to go and purchase some art for those bare walls.
Yeah, no kidding. And in the past, I've seen items as large as furniture pieces and as small as small jewelry pieces. I presume you'll have the same range, huh?
Yeah, we have everything from, we have jewelry designers and artists, and we also have people that are wood makers. So, and then couple that with the photography and the painting, you have a nice diversity of offerings.
Okay, you got good weather, as I understand in the forecast, taking place along Broadway from Belmont to Hawthorne. The official hours for the Lakeview East Festival of the Arts are Saturday the 11th and Sunday the 12th, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., with additional hours for live music and food and drink and tents until 10 p.m. on Saturday. Well, good luck to you, and it's good to have it back. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.